torture is that they forever consume but are never satisfied. Your torture is that you are forever consumed. Also, by the 1960s, consumer-grade refrigerators were common, so the whole thing would have been a bad investment anyway. The tires left twin overlapping wakes behind us as we rolled across the shallow pool of the parking lot. There were no visible vehicles or other signs of activity. Ted said, "Do a slow lap around the exterior. See what we can see." "Now," I said to Ted, "when we go in, I want you to keep one thing fixed in your mind. Whatever Nymph is, I can tell you what he almost certainly isn't. And that's a greasy pedophile in a suit with a smoking habit. What you saw in your driveway that day, that was just how this particular thing chose to present itself to you. It may look completely different now. Do you understand?" "What, like a disguise?" "Once," I said, "we had a dainty young woman come in asking us to investigate a haunting in her parents' house. We walk in, the door slams behind us, and the woman falls apart. All that's left is a pile of snakes where the girl had been standing, patches of their scales colored like the dress she'd been wearing." Ted tried to picture it. "The whole time you talked to her, you didn't notice she was snakes?" John said, "They have, techniques for that." I said, "And then John started dating a girl named Nikki, who I assumed was made out of snakes, but it turned out that's just the way she is. She has been nothing but nice to you, Dave." Ted said, "My voice, on the phone. You think these things took Maggie by pretending to be me? Is that what I'm gonna find in there, something that looks and sounds just like I do?" I shrugged. Past experience has only taught us not to rely on past experience. We completed our circuit and rolled to a stop, about 30 feet from the front door. John parked with the Jeep facing away from the building and left the engine running. In this line of work, you always assume that you're 30 seconds from needing to fly off into the horizon in a mad panic. "Well," Ted said, as he pulled the slide on his pistol and stuffed it down the back of his pants, "let's just assume ambush here." He nodded toward the building. "Only two doors. Those are choke points. I've got line and hooks. I say we get up on the roof, rappel down to the windows, come crashing in on the fuckers." I said, "I'd break both of my ankles the moment I landed, before breaking my neck a half second later. This is going to have to be a traditional walk in the front door entry, at least for me and John." Ted seemed pretty disappointed by that, but didn't argue. We circled around to the rear of the Jeep to retrieve our weapons. Ted brought out an M4 assault rifle, which I recognized from having used one in a video game recently, and a pump shotgun that he slung over his shoulder as a backup. John pulled out a gun with a 6-inch wide barrel connected to a compressed air tank he strapped to his back, one of those cannons they use to fire T-shirts at the crowd at basketball games. I would be carrying a small faded wooden cross, supposedly carved from the very beams upon which the actual crucifixion was performed on Jim Caviezel in The Passion of the Christ. Taped to it was a pair of small Bose speakers, a battery pack, and an iPod shuffle loaded with 80s power ballads. I explained our gear to Ted, who gave the weapons a skeptical look. I said, "Trust me. What's the range?" "For the music? I guess wherever it's audible. But it's not fatal to them? It's more of an area effect deterrent?" "Yeah, they hate it a lot." "How long do targets stay incapacitated?" "I don't." "And the cross, do they have to see it to be affected, or is it enough just to be in proximity?" The second one, I think." "All right, so what's the range?" John said, "This is not an exact science, Ted." Ted didn't reply, but his body language said it all. I'm on my own here, again. We sloshed through the standing water. I had never bought rain boots because I knew that it would immediately stop raining the moment I did, and arrived at the main entrance, an arched brick doorway partially boarded up by what looked like the original planks the crew had hastily nailed into place in 1961. Standing guard beside the door was a concrete snowman, about 6 feet tall, arms made of rusted rebar, the top half absolutely covered in bird shit. The eyes and mouth were three misshapen, eroded holes in the concrete, as if the thing was wailing in terror and dread. Rainwater puddled and splattered out of its ragged eye holes, like flowing tears. The words, "Mr. Frosty," were etched into his chest, like the epitaph on a particularly eccentric tombstone. The old ice factory mascot had seen better days. A gap had been pried loose in the boarded-up doorway, large enough for a person to slide through. But it looked like it had been that way since before I was born. There were still no obvious signs anyone had been here recently. John nodded to me, and I hit the iPod, which started playing Bon Jovi's "Livin' on a Prayer." Ted clicked on a flashlight attached to the barrel of his rifle and aimed the light through the gap, sweeping it slowly across the interior. He slid inside, quickly whipping his head back and forth to check for anyone waiting to waylay us inside the door. John went next. I brought up the rear and clicked on my own flashlight. The interior smelled like wet rust and a recently snuffed candle. A row of huge, charred machines loomed above us like the aftermath of a robot battle. There were tanks and pipes and gears and 15-foot-tall iron objects shaped like wagon wheels connected to chutes designed to deliver coffin-sized blocks of ice to ground level. All of it was warped and misshapen, metal parts caught in the process of drooping, dripping, or dissolving entirely according to their various melting points. I shined the light overhead. The brick had in fact liquefied and then cooled into thousands of tiny spikes that made the whole vast space look like a torture chamber. I imagined the curved ceiling snapping shut the moment some hooded inquisitor threw a switch. We crept steadily forward, the music echoing around the dead space. A light flared up to my left, John, lighting a cigarette. He said into the darkness, "All right, we're here, fart song. What's your deal?" No answer from inside the building, or at least none that could be heard over Mr. Bon Jovi insisting we have to hold on to what we've got and that it doesn't make a difference if we make it or not. We advanced, Ted swinging his gun lamp around in both directions to light up nooks in between scorched machinery in which enemies could be lying in wait. We passed through an open doorway into an emptier room that had probably been a loading area, a truck-sized door at the opposite end, the only other exit. How numb would your fingers get loading ice all day? John said, "Come out where we can see you, you son of a bitch. I have to be in court at 8, so whatever you've got in mind, we need to wrap it up." I said, "Yeah, and I have to pick Amy up from work soon, otherwise she has to get a ride home with this dude bro she works with, and I think he's trying to get in her pants. It's a long story, but the point is we don't have time to dick around." Ted's phone rang. Hey, that worked. He motioned for me to cut the music, then put the call on speaker. The little girl's voice said, "Hello? Baby, we're here. Do you see us? I'm shining a flashlight." The night wheel was scary. I screamed when it started spinning and everybody's faces went away. "We're going to watch the flying goats. They let me lick the luck lizard, and we've been eating hot dogs that squirm in the bun. Maggie, listen, I want you to yell for me. Yell anything. Cry out real loud so I can hear you." She'd hung up. Ted cursed, tried to dial back again, and once again it rang and rang. John held up a hand and said, "Shh." We all heard it. A faint, musical ringtone that I recognized as the theme song from a recent Disney movie. It was about a princess who has to learn to be independent or something. The sound was coming from right below our feet. Three flashlight beams swung down to illuminate the floor in front of us. There was a gap where the floorboards had been ripped aside. Below it was a patch of loose dirt, like a freshly dug shallow grave. Ted dropped to his knees. He started digging away with his hands, flinging dirt behind him like a dog, crying out for his daughter. But how would she have made the call from... About a foot down, he found a phone. Still on, smeared with mud. Ted tossed it aside and kept digging. Something was moving in the dirt, in the shadows, ripples in the clumps of muck, things squirming around his hands. And then they were gone, as if having burrowed into the earth, hiding from the light. Or maybe it had been nothing. Ted kept digging, but there was no little girl down there, alive or dead. He sat back, chest heaving with the effort. He grabbed the muddy phone. He looked it over. It displayed only its lock screen. He screamed, "Hey! Where is she? Nymph! You here, you son of a bitch?" I shook my head. "She's not here, and neither is Nymph. It's a wild goose ch—" I had turned to walk away, and immediately bumped into an inhuman figure that had been standing right behind me. I screamed and tumbled backward. Ted jumped to his feet, whipped the shotgun off his back, and yelled for me to stay down. He fired and pumped and fired again, but John was yelling for him to stop. "Hey, hey, cool it. It's just the snowman." I looked up, and the figure was, of course, just that stupid snowman mascot, now scarred across its chest from where the shotgun pellets had gouged the concrete and ricocheted away. Ted had succeeded in blowing one of its rebar arms off. In the panic and tension, we had forgotten that, of course, the Mr. Frosty mascot was there inside the factory, in the center of the storage room where it had probably stood for 80 years. Where else would it be? I could now remember approaching it as we entered the room 30 seconds ago, plain as day. Feeling ridiculous, I stood up and brushed myself off. I cursed when I saw that I had landed right on top of my iPod, smashing it. John was blinking at the snowman as if confused by it, then went to help Ted. He was sweeping his flashlight around each corner, determined to search every inch of the place before admitting defeat. An hour of the three of us looking in and around the factory turned up no sign of either Nymph or Maggie. We rode back through town in silence, listening to the wipers squeak their complaints from the other side of the windshield. Ted said, "What now?" I said, "There are two threads to follow up on here. Who is Nymph and where is Maggie? I'm guessing one will answer the other." John said to me, "You go to the library and see if you can find any reference to Joy Park. I'll take Nymph. See if I can find anybody else around town who's encountered him. If I track him down, I'll give you a call after I've killed him." Ted said, "No, you get a beat on him, you call me. Not the cops, neither. I want to be the one to do it. I'm putting the word out for manhunt volunteers. Get as many people looking as we can. Got a friend I served with. He can be in town by this afternoon. And I'm clearly not going to the library, John. I can search the internet from my phone. From some place with free Wi-Fi and pancakes. Speaking of which," I was holding the muddy phone we'd found buried at the ice factory, turning it over in my hands. I turned it on, again, just got the lock screen. "Anybody know how to hack a phone?" "Amy probably does." "Yeah, I'll ask. Wait, does that mean she can get into my phone anytime she wants?" "Only way to find out? Put a bunch of pics of naked dudes on there and see if you could detect a change in mood afterward." As we pulled up to the Knoll home, Ted said, "If what you're saying about imposters and such is true, we should have a system in case that thing tries to imitate one of us." I was taken aback. "Man, that's a good idea. You should do this for a living. You make a lot of money doing this? The password is Bushmaster. Don't forget it. We encounter each other, we ask the password. Got it?" John said, "Got it. Now, I figure we got 40 hours before this goes from rescue to revenge, so there's no time to lose. I'll get on it right after I go to court on this public nudity thing." Chapter 4. A Monster's Pictures, A Grieving Widow, Sex. I felt water squish out of my pants when I settled into my Saturn. Through my weeping windshield, I watched Ted trudge up to his front door, knowing that inside he was about to be ambushed by the accusatory silence of that empty house. I couldn't quite put my finger on it, but I just had a feeling this one wasn't going to end well. Maybe it's because they pretty much never do. I pulled away and considered heading straight for Waffle House, since I'm usually much more effective with a big wad of cheap comfort food in me, but instead headed toward the used bookstore downtown. In the basement, they had a collection of odd, out-of-print, and banned books. I would probably find nothing pertaining to this case, but Amy's birthday was next weekend, and they had a signed copy of Douglas Adams's The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy that I'd noticed her gaze longingly at when we were there about 6 months ago. Look, I have a life outside of work, okay? I dug out my phone and dialed as I turned down Brown Street. The driver's side windshield wiper had a crack in the rubber blade that left behind an arc of rainwater right in the center of my field of vision. It had failed exactly in the way that would annoy me most. Amy answered. Hey, you're up early. Got a call from John, situation with a missing kid, thinks it might be a thing. Can you get a ride home? A missing kid? Tell me everything. I just did. There's not much more to it. She just vanished, like she fell through a hole in reality. We followed up on one lead, turned out to be nothing. Not sure there's much to be done, and I'm really not sure how we're going to get paid. There's a missing child? And you're talking to me about payment? I'm going to reach through this phone and slap you. And you know that's not easy for me. Did you find the muffin? Already eaten. Did you say you could or couldn't get a ride home? Sean will do it. Hey, I was thinking about the argument we had yesterday, and having slept on it, I've decided that you are even more wrong than I thought you were then. Looks like you need to sleep on it some more. The argument had been over whether or not Neo should have just left everyone in the Matrix, since their quality of life was clearly better inside it than out. I say no, she says yes. I should note here that Amy has seen the Matrix at least 30 times. When I got her the Blu-ray for Christmas, she became visibly upset when she saw that they had done this odd color correction thing that gave the whole movie a weird green tint. She downloaded editing software on her laptop and has been manually correcting it, shot by shot. Oh, I said, and I just want to let you know that I've completely forgotten your birthday next week because I'm a man and thus care nothing about your feelings. Oh, okay, thanks for letting me know ahead of time. I pulled up to the bookstore, the interior still dark. I realized just now that it wouldn't open for another 20 minutes. I wasn't used to being up this early. I grabbed the muddy phone we'd picked up at the ice factory and turned it on, the lock screen asking for the 4-digit passcode. Hey, do you know how to hack into a phone, like to get past the lock screen? Did you ever have a class on that? Whose phone is it? Do you know their social security number? Lots of times it's the last 4 digits. We found it looking for that little girl. I would be surprised if this guy has a social security card. Wait, does the phone belong to a guy, or is this some kind of weird monster situation? Don't know. It's an iPhone, if that helps. What code would an unholy predator of the night have on his phone? I was sick the day they taught that. I mindlessly punched in the code for my own phone. 6669. It unlocked. Why did I know that would work? I said, hey, I think I hacked it. The home screen looked normal. I wasn't sure what I was expecting. I tapped on the icon for any stored photos and video and braced myself for the worst. The first photo was of a plate of breakfast food. Looked like Eggs Benedict. I swiped it aside. I sucked in a breath and Amy heard it. What? What are you seeing? The second photo was of a little blonde girl, bound and bleeding, her mouth gagged with duct tape. I was going to take a wild guess and say this was Margaret Maggie Knoll. I said, not sure. I swiped to the next photo, a picture of an orange tabby cat licking the lens. I swiped again. The little girl again. Her limbs were a tangled red mess. She had been bound and gagged and then crushed somehow, like a giant had forgotten she was in his back pocket before sitting down. I closed my eyes. I wondered, at age 8, did she know? Was she aware of what kind of universe she had been born into? Did she have even the faintest hint that this was one of the possible outcomes of her life? That she wouldn't grow up to be a Disney princess or marry a handsome man at a fancy wedding, or have kids of her own, that she would wind up terrified and alone, in the dark, as some monster's plaything. At the end, had she still held out hope that her daddy would come rescue her, or that the crazy man would soften at the sound of her cries? Or, in her final moment, had she gotten just a glimpse of just how little of a shit the universe gives about her? Did she have the realization that what she had always thought of as a normal human life was just a tightrope walk over an ocean of unfathomable suffering? I hope not. I said, "Well, shit, Amy." Amy said, "What?" "I think we've got photos of the victim here. It's bad."
"What is it?"
"Bad. You don't want to know. We're too late, let's put it that way."
"Oh. Oh, God."
I swiped the picture. The next photo was of John, walking in the doorway of what looked like a church, holding the t-shirt cannon. I furrowed my brow. He was still in court, right? "Remember, Nymph wanted you to see what you're seeing. This, too, is part of the game." I swiped. John again. Dead. Eyes open, a cascade of dried vomit running down the side of his black faux leather sofa. Drug paraphernalia on the glass coffee table in front of him.
"David?"
I thought, no. This wasn't denial. This was math. Even if he'd skipped his court date, John hadn't had the time to get home, change clothes, he wasn't in his suit in the photo, get out his stash and dose himself to death. This was bullshit. All of it. More games. "Yeah, these are fake. There's pictures of us on here, but they're, not real."
"Oh, that's creepy."
"Yeah, but that's good. Means the girl may still be okay. He's taunting us." I swiped. This one was of John and Amy. She was crying. John was comforting her. They were in my apartment. "Ignore it. It's nothing." I swiped again. Amy, crawling, screaming, a pale, blurry shape descending on her from behind. "Seriously, why even bother looking at these?" She asked, "Are there any of me in there?" "No, I've got to go. I'll see you in a bit." "Come straight home. Don't leave me out of this." "You need to get some sleep. You've been working all night."
"There's a missing girl. David!"
"I love you." I hung up and swiped to the next pic. Actually, this one was a video. I braced myself and hit play. It was a shot from the passenger seat of the car I was sitting in, being filmed right now. The cameraman was watching me, watching the phone, in real time. I turned and looked and someone is there. No one was there. I looked back down at the phone and saw that I was holding a filthy, pink plastic toy that was only shaped like a phone, a faded and peeled sticker on the front bearing the likeness of a Disney princess. It had a single plastic button at the bottom, and when I pressed it, it played the theme from the movie. That's all it did. I closed my eyes and groaned. It was going to be a long goddamn day. Note about the following. The accounts of events that occurred while I was not present, particularly those submitted by John, should not be accepted as wholly or even partially true. They are included here only to help fill in some gaps in the timeline of events. But in retrospect, I now feel like they only add to the confusion. For this, I apologize. John. After they returned from the ice factory, John had stood in the Knowles driveway, facing Dave and Ted. John's shirt was soaked through. He peeled it off and flexed, the rain splattering off his muscled chest. "All right," growled Dave, rubbing a rough hand over his stubbled jaw. "Less than 40 hours, that's what we've got to solve this. I'm gonna go search the archives for what I can find on Joy Park. You go see if you can track down this Nymph bastard. But John, you find him. Remember, we need him alive." John lit a cigarette. "I won't make any fucking promises." Dave ran toward his Saturn, slid across the hood, and landed in the driver's seat. He revved the engine and squealed out of the yard. John mounted the Jeep and unleashed the Tiger under its hood, raindrops raking the windshield as he tore through the early morning gloom. He headed for the courthouse. At least one piece of luck fell in their favor that morning, thought John. The judge in his public indecency case was Roy Hubel. John and Dave had just 6 months prior freed his mansion from an entity that presented itself as a giant spider made of the bloody bones of his deceased wife. That meant he owed them one. Sure enough, the judge told the prosecutor to make a deal, and John got off with probation and a promise to, in the judge's words, keep that anaconda caged. There are kids around, and you don't need to go setting them up with false expectations. On the way out, John bumped into Herm Bowman, the detective who had bailed on the Maggie Knoll case earlier that morning. John grabbed the passing Bowman by the elbow and said, "Hey, we're still working this Knoll thing. We'd have already found the girl if I didn't have to come tend to this bullshit. But I knew if I didn't show, they'd put out a warrant for my arrest. And I know how you guys hate having to get out in the rain. But now, I need your help." Bowman shook off John's hand. "You want sympathy? You can find it in the dictionary between shit and syphilis. Ted didn't want me talking to the mother, Loretta, but I'm doing it anyway. She live in town? What do you know about her?" "Yeah, in that yellow house next to Taco Bill." He didn't misspeak. That's the name of the restaurant. "But instead of wasting your time, why don't you just go back home and shoot up with whatever drugs you're on this week?"
"I will," said John as he turned toward the door. "But first, I have to go do your job."
Thunder clapped as John tore out of the courthouse parking lot. He flew past the closed drive-through liquor store, past Curry's Tire and Body, with its terrifying mascot made of tires standing sentry out front, and Taco Bill, a Taco Bell that was given the order to close by corporate, only to be stubbornly kept open by the owner. He had altered the sign over the entrance by sawing out an extra L from the sign in the parking lot, turning it into an I, and attaching it with duct tape, and modified the menu to serve a combination of vaguely approximated Taco Bell dishes prepared by his wife, with a full range of hard liquor added to the beverage list. Smoking was allowed, and after 9 p.m., all of the TVs inside were switched to softcore Cinemax porn. Everyone agreed it was not only an improvement, but was now the best restaurant in town. Loretta's house was next door, a rundown 1970s-era ranch house with filthy yellow siding that had probably been on there since the Carter administration. No distinct decorations on the outside, probably a rental. John knocked, and a tired but handsome 30-something woman with mousy brown hair and sad eyes opened the door, clutching closed a bathrobe. She said nothing. John said, "Ma'am, I'm not going to ask to come in because I've already intruded too much just by making you answer your door. But we're working with your husband on Maggie's disappearance as consultants. I have a few questions, but if you don't want to talk, I'll leave. Just say the word. I'm not the police. But I'm telling you now, they can't help you. And what's more, if we can't find the girl or the man who took her, then I think the cops will turn their eyes toward you and Ted as suspects. I don't want that to happen."
"Ted says Maggie was just gone, like she just turned into smoke and blew away. Was he telling the truth? He didn't do something to her, did he?"
"No.
We have reason to believe it was, well, something else. I know you've been through an unthinkable ordeal this morning, but I promise you, I'm here to help. If you're worried that I'm armed, let me show you."
John peeled off his shirt to show that he had no weapon stashed in his waistband. His naked torso glistened in the rain.
"All right, I'll give you a few minutes, then I have to get ready for work. Come in."
Loretta handed John a towel before retreating to the kitchen to make coffee. Hers was another barren home, a place quickly rented after the separation, maybe in hopes it wouldn't last long. She came back with the coffee, and John said,
"Ted says he actually had warning this was about to happen. A strange man named Nymph came to the house a week ago, making weird threats. Did he tell you about that?"
"No. but we don't talk.
Did anything like that happen to you?
No. Ted asked me the same thing earlier when he called. Did he tell you about the drawings?
The what?
He probably wasn't even listening. Here. Loretta shuffled into her bedroom, and John followed. She handed him a stack of drawings on dog-eared construction paper. Magic markers, stick figures, flowers, houses, mountains. Fill colors spilling wildly over the lines. No matter who you are or where you're from, we can all look upon the raw, energetic creations of children and agree that they are very shitty artists. Loretta said,
"Those are all from the last week. We homeschool. I was doing an activity where she was to draw the future. Instead of spaceships and flying cars, she drew this."
The first drawing featured a crude house shape with a steeple, a cross on the front, so a church. The next drawing was a crowd of stick figures, but in the background was that church again. The next was a drawing of the family, scribbled strands of yellow around the head of the smallest figure. And there was the church, up on a hill in the background. She'd even drawn a little angel floating in the sky above it, her haphazard scrawls making it look like it had about 8 limbs. John said,
"This church? That's what we're looking at?"
"The church and the man without a head."
John looked back down at the stick figure family portrait. Mommy, Daddy, Maggie with the hair. And next to her, another stick figure, with no circle where the head should be.
"The one with the crowd of people, you'll find him in there too. He's in all of them."
"Did she ever talk about it? Like maybe it was a dream she had or something?"
"I asked her after the first one, the portrait of us at church. I said, 'Who's this guy here without a head?' And she said, 'That's not a guy, it's a drawing.'"
Loretta laughed.
"Maggie was like that. I thought she kept including him in the other drawings as a joke because I had pointed him out, but now I've spent all morning looking back on everything she said and did, picking it apart, trying to find clues. Like in a movie, you know, there'd always be some clue. In real life, nothing makes sense."
John said, "I'm going to ask you what is going to seem like a very strange question. Was there ever a situation where Maggie acted like she had spoken to you or her father or otherwise interacted with you, only you have no memory of it? Like she had made up a memory of a conversation or maybe mistook someone else for you or Ted? Either one?"
All of the color drained from Loretta's face. Me. I walked among the shelves in the bookstore's basement, smelling that old book scent that would probably mean nothing to future generations. Amy is all about that smell, of old paper and ink and time, pages touched by long-dead hands. I think she just likes that sense of being among ancient knowledge, feeling like the past is something sacred rather than the actions of a bunch of bucket shitters who are even more stupid and superstitious than we are now. To me, it just smells like old sweat and dirt, but it means something to Amy, and that's what matters today. Even though the whole thing is completely pointless, since she has access to every book ever written via a device that is never out of arm's reach. That reminded me. I brought up my phone and did a quick search for Joy Park. Titties. My screen was full of them. Joy Park, as it turned out, was the name of a very famous, very big-breasted Korean porn star. After the pages and pages and pages of Joy Park titty pics ran out, all I got was a couple of links to a place in Akron, Ohio, just a regular old park with basketball courts and such, and a few more non-porn girls with that name. Nothing related to anything weird, no news articles about missing kids or occult rituals or anything else remotely interesting. I tried searching for any mentions whatsoever of people with the last name Nymph and found that wasn't even a real surname, which I guess shouldn't have surprised me. With that, I was out of ideas. Maybe John's thing would pan out, or maybe he would destroy half the town again. I was cold and achy and wanted to go back to bed. My wet clothes were sticking to every part of my body. I sighed and made my way over to the shelf of signed editions,
some of them in a scuffed plexiglass case, some sitting out, depending on whether or not the author was still alive. I started to get a sinking feeling when I spotted a signed hardcover copy of Fear Nothing by Dean Kuntz for $100. Next to it, a signed Neil Gaiman's The Sandman for $125. I stared at the price tags and thought, why don't you fucking kill yourself? I have that thought a lot, actually. Hey, did you know that people making less than $34,000 a year are 50% more likely to commit suicide? I looked it up. Did you know that number shoots up to 72% for the unemployed? I heard a guy on talk radio go on and on and on about how people on food stamps are living the good life off the government teat, and all I could think was, yes, it's such a party that sometimes we blow our fucking brains out rather than get humiliated by another government aid employee. A little while back, John and I had gotten drunk on the occasion of our 10-year high school reunion. Oh, we didn't attend the actual reunion. We had just started drinking after coming to the realization that it had been 10 years and that we had made virtually no progress in our lives. You know what it's like, John had said. The rapture. Like from the book of Revelation, when all the souls of the righteous get sucked up into heaven. What he had meant was that there had been a point several years ago when everybody we graduated with were all equally poor. College kids, people working shitty customer service, the unemployed ones still living at home. All of us 20-somethings were all doing the same stuff for fun, going to the same parties. We had nothing. But we were young and thin, well, not me, and nobody expected anything from us. But then one by one, the smart kids, the ambitious kids, the kids with rich parents, they all ascended. They got their degrees and careers and babies. Most moved away, and the ones who didn't stopped hanging out. Until it was just us, the rejects, left behind, the faithless and doomed, the broke, and the broken. Ever since he'd said that, I couldn't stop thinking of it that way, that we had been cast out as heretics to the Western world's one true religion. My resume is worthless. It turns out that managing a now defunct video store in your 20s while solving monster crimes qualifies you for absolutely nothing else. Society just doesn't need me. I'm that extra screw you have left over after you've put together an IKEA desk. Maybe you throw it in a drawer, thinking it'll eventually become obvious what it was for later on. Then, a few years down the road, you come across it while cleaning and just toss it out. So, now I'm standing here birthday shopping for Amy, who at the moment is the only one of us with any kind of a stable income. Using our joint account for this is basically taking money out of her purse to buy something for her that she may or may not even want. How do you set your price limit in that scenario? Spending too much isn't generosity. It's forcing her to work overtime next month to make up the difference. Here, baby, for your birthday, I stole another autumn Saturday from your life that you'll never get back. Oh, and she's also having to pay for some of her prescriptions out of pocket due to the cut-rate health insurance at the call center. She has back problems and spaces out the pills so that a 30-day prescription will last 60. So now I also have that cross to bear. My inability to learn a useful skill equals Amy's actual physical agony. Why don't you fucking kill yourself? I mean, I do have a rare skill, but being able to piss a stream of turkey feathers is also a rare skill. Rare does not equal lucrative. Not that there aren't ways to cash in on being a freak show. We get offers, but charging a fee to do what we do, to free somebody's home from what they think is an evil spirit, or whatever, automatically puts you in some very shady company, and the scammers will always take most of the business. After all, they're just telling the customers what they want to hear. I'm not good at doing that. I browsed the shelves, the titles seemingly arranged in random order. The copy of Hitchhikers was still there in the glass case. It was $275. Amy would not be getting this book for her birthday. And she would be fine with that. She knows the situation. She tells me not to worry about it every chance she gets.
We have a roof over our heads, she says. We have food. We have electricity. We have each other. By medieval standards, she points out, we'd have been considered rich. Don't beat yourself up over an ideal dreamed up by a bunch of marketing jerks on the coasts whose BMWs trigger cocaine-sniffing dogs from 6 blocks away. It's fine, she says. You're doing important work. Remember that I love you. Why don't you fucking kill yourself? John. Loretta said, about 2 weeks ago, Maggie spent hours running around the house with a fly swatter. I thought it was some game she had invented, stalking flies, swatting them. Then a few days later, she brings me this shoebox full of dead flies and says, do I have to eat them all now? I ask her what she's talking about, and she thinks I told her to do that. I thought it was a dream she'd had. I made her throw them away, and she didn't understand. Is there something wrong with her? Is that what happened? She became confused and wandered away? I don't know, but I don't want to eliminate any possibilities. John sipped the woman's surprisingly good coffee and studied the drawings. This church she kept drawing. Is this your church? Is church a big deal to you guys? She'd never drawn it before. The one Ted took us to is that biker church. They hold services in that old motel. It doesn't look anything like a traditional church. In her drawings, it always has that steeple and that cross in the same spot. There is a church like this in town. Do you know it? It's next to a pond and a haunted coal mine? No. Maybe she went there with friends? It's possible. What do you think it means? Maybe nothing. Maybe everything. I'll go check it out either way. John stood. I'll leave you be. You've been a big help, and I know this has been hard for you. She stood, meeting his eyes. It has been hard. I've just been so lonely here. Ted coming back from the war and breaking things off like he did. Now Maggie going missing. Do you know what that's like? To have a hole in your life so big that your life is nothing but whole? I think we all feel like that at times. Those of us who are lucky, we have someone we can cling to in those times when life feels, as you said, like one big butthole. That's all I want sometimes, someone to cling to, if even just for a moment. She dropped her robe. She was naked underneath. John looked her up and down. I'm in the middle of a case, miss. Time is of the essence. Your little girl's life could be at stake. She stepped forward, running a finger down his chest. I promise. I won't be long. I can promise I will be long. John let his pants fall. I'm telling you right now, this won't cure your loneliness or replace what your husband took from you when he fled. At best, all I can do is diminish his memory by giving you something far beyond what he ever could. That will have to do. She lay back on the bed. But maybe even that is asking too much. You see, my husband was quite the... Oh, my fucking God! Do you want me to stop, Ms. Knoll? If you stop, I will kill you. And so, he did not stop until her orgasmic cries filled the lonely halls of her modest home. John thrusted his staff into the moist... me. John, I said into my phone, it is really, really important that you give me the actual story and not a bunch of bullshit. The truth is enough. You don't need to sex it up. So please, back up and just boil it down to the parts that, you know, actually happened. The thing with the drawings of the church, that was real, right? Yeah, a little traditional country-style church like you'd see on a postcard. White steeple, probably some stained glass. Like the one at Mind's Eye? That's a little wooded area with a pond around what had been a coal mine back in the olden days. Yeah. Okay, meet me there. The creepy kid drawing thing is a little cliche, but it's literally the only lead we've got. John said, there's something else, though I don't know what to make of this either. Ted's car got stolen,
Old restored Impala. I found out just before I called you. It was missing from his garage when he got back from the ice factory. Huh. Maybe this whole thing was one big ploy to steal his car. Oh, I was able to get into the phone, the one we recovered from the ice factory.
John paused for a confused moment.
What phone? The pink toy one?
I mean, is that what it looked like to you the whole time?
Yeah. It had a Disney princess or something on it.
When you asked about hacking it, I thought you were joking. Were you able to make it work? Somehow?
Yeah, maybe.
And?
It had photos and a video on it. Fake ones. They were pics of the little girl looking mangled and bloody. But I don't think it means she's actually been hurt.
How do you know they were fake?
There were pics of us on there. We were dead in those, too.
Yeah.
I have a question, John. Who's paying us for this?
What?
Amy doesn't get enough hours at the call center, and I don't get any hours at the anything.
Who's paying us?
It was never discussed. I don't think Ted has much money. The cops called us in. Shouldn't they have like a consultants fund in the budget?
I think that would require us having some kind of license or expertise or something.
We've had this discussion before. Did you find anything on Joy Park?
Well, it's a porn star, otherwise no.
Yeah, I saw that, said John.
You think those boobs are real?
I consulted my notes. I did some digging. If she got a boob job, she got it early. She's about 27, I think. Her earliest shoots are from 5 or 6 years ago, and she had big boobs then. Looks pretty natural when she's on her back.
You see that set where she's coming out of the pool? Jesus!
It felt like we'd gotten off the subject somewhat. Then I suddenly remembered what I should have done when the call started. Hey, what's the code word?
The what?
The, password Ted set up to make sure you're you and I'm me.
John said, oh, right. It was...
Wait, why do I have to say it?
If you're an imposter, maybe this call is just a way to find out about the password.
How would I have known we have a password at all?
John considered for a moment.
It was Bushmaster.
Yeah, I remember, because that was my nickname in high school.
Though if you...
Because I got so much bush.
Though if you were an imposter, I think I'd know within seconds.
You think one of them could mimic the stupid shit that comes out of your mouth?
There was a moment of silence before John said,
that's actually a good question.
What is?
If it tried to be one of us, would it know how to say everything we just said about the boobs and such?
I wish we didn't know how to say it.
Serious question.
No, I mean, I don't think so.
How could it?
Chapter 5. Amy's Breakfast with Evil.
Amy. Amy Sullivan's cubicle neighbor, Sean, was taking her home from work in his new Mustang. She was in the passenger seat eating a single-serving box of Cocoa Pebbles by shaking them into her mouth, then washing it down with a bottle of Orange Crush. The selection in the break room vending machine at the office actually matched her preferred diet really well. Sean asked,
"Are you sure you don't want anything else to eat? You're just downing handfuls of sugar there."
"I'm fine."
"I don't know how you stay that size on your diet. I wouldn't be able to fit behind this steering wheel."
"I have a painting of myself in my closet. It gets fatter every time I eat."
"You have a what?"
She wondered if he was really just afraid she would spill something in his car, despite having told her it was fine every time she asked. Amy was trying to balance her meal with her one remaining hand, and she knew it probably looked precarious. She had briefly experimented with a prosthetic left hand to replace the one that had gotten lopped off in the car crash years ago. She and David had picked it out together from a catalog her doctor had given her, a metallic Terminator-esque model that they both thought was hilarious. It kind of looked like she had gotten some of her fake human skin ripped off, revealing the robot underneath that had been there all along, which, Amy had said, would actually make sense. If someone was going to create a cyborg intended to pass for human, it was more logical to disguise it as 100 pounds of freckles and glasses than a muscular Austrian. The hand had only lasted about a month, though, before she stopped strapping it on every morning. The reason, she told everyone, was that it just wasn't convenient to use. It looked like a robot hand from the future, but in reality was just operated by a cable that ran around her other shoulder, and she had to open and close it by shrugging. It didn't have little motors in it or anything, like Luke's hand in Star Wars. Those were for people with Cadillac health insurance. It didn't have much in the way of grip strength, either, and she found herself just doing everything with her right hand anyway. It was just habit. She'd now lived without the other hand almost as long as she'd lived with it. But the real problem was that, with the robot hand, it was like she suddenly had a "Please hit on me" sign draped over her neck, written in a language that only the creepiest of guys could read. Those guys loved the robot hand, each and every one of them broaching the subject as if they were the first. She didn't know if it was a fetish thing or if they just thought they could get her cheaper because she was a damaged floor model. All she knew was that whenever she entered the one remaining video game store in town, all four male employees would follow her from shelf to shelf, desperately trying to make conversation. "Hey, do you have a .a account?" But the convention had been the final straw. A group of former college friends had invited her to a gaming convention in Indianapolis and offered to pay her way. David would never have come within a 5-mile radius of a gaming convention, even if he was bleeding profusely and just needed to pass it on the way to the emergency room. Everyone was going in costume, and Amy only needed a cheap pink wig and an afternoon modifying a white skirt and top to go as Ulala from Space Channel 5. A costume she had picked specifically because that character wore white elbow-length gloves. But she had accidentally left the gloves at home, and everybody had thought the mecha hand was part of her costume, since to people unfamiliar with the game, the getup just registered as generic space girl. Amy wondered if they thought she was so dedicated to the role that she had hacked off one of her limbs just to complete the ensemble. Anyway, some pictures of her at the convention got posted on the internet, and they went somewhat viral since Amy is kind of a minor celebrity in some circles. She had quickly gotten snowed under with messages from creepers, and at least three of them had dug up her phone number. Half the messages were asking why she didn't go for the more revealing version of the costume with the bare midriff. The other half were informing her that she was too ugly to wear such a thing in public. She was never in any actual danger, as far as she knew, but the sheer volume of it freaked her out and, well, brought back some bad memories. From that point on, she had this feeling like all eyes were on her the moment she stepped outside with the metal hand. She even had a panic attack once. So she put it away. She never told David why. The Mustang passed a flooded cornfield, and Amy wondered if the road itself wouldn't be underwater a week from now. Or a day. She wondered if that would be a valid excuse to miss work, or if they'd just fire everybody who didn't own a canoe. At this rate, the office itself would be under before too long. She imagined everyone sitting at their desks, neck deep in flood water, taking calls while fish swam in front of their monitors. She asked, "What happens to the rabbits when it's like this?"
"What rabbits?"
"Don't rabbits live in tunnels? And moles and mice and such? Do they drown when it floods?" Thinking quickly, Sean said,
"Rabbits are fast. They can outrun the water."
"But what if they've got babies? How would they get them out of there?"
"Baby rabbits are good swimmers. They're not like humans where they have to take classes. They can do it coming out of the womb. They're fine."
She wondered how long he would keep making stuff up if she kept asking. She had asked David that same question the day before, and his answer had been, "It started raining weeks ago. Those lazy bastards have had plenty of time to get to the high ground. What are they waiting for? FEMA?" Most of the people Amy worked with were cool, which is one of the biggest factors in determining your quality of life, if you think about it. She had parlayed her 5 semesters of programming classes into a job that involved no coding at all. A call center for an alarm company, in which virtually all of the calls involved sensors getting tripped by dogs. Business had been booming for the home alarm sector in the area. Everybody in Undisclosed wanted a system, even though not one home in 20 had anything worth stealing. It was mostly scared people hoping to fend off monsters. Whether or not the kind of creatures that turned up around town would even trip a sensor or show up on camera was a mystery to Amy. But of course she knew that what people were really buying was the ability to get a good night's sleep, which was ironic considering Amy had applied for the 11 to 8 shift specifically because she couldn't sleep herself. She liked it well enough, even at $9 an hour. She felt like a policeman, guarding people in their beds. Well, at least the ones who could afford a home security system. Sean said, "Do you guys have a plan if you get flooded out?" "David says we can get a bunch of those inflatable sex dolls from the shop downstairs and strap them together as a raft." Sean laughed, but in a way that made it clear he didn't approve. David made constant jokes about how he thought Sean was trying to get into her pants, which meant that David did in fact think Sean was trying to get into her pants. Amy had long ago learned the secret to reading people's minds, a mystical 2-step process that involved, 1, shutting her mouth, and 2, listening to what they say. People will scream their secrets if you just give them a chance. Even the liars can't resist letting the truth ooze through the gaps. So, David would make his snarky little remarks about Sean, and Amy would tell him that the guy was married. David would then say something to the effect of, "You have a lot to learn about guys, Amy." But he was wrong. She was pretty sure she understood the game better than he did. If she were to tell Sean to pull over right now, then rip open her shirt and ask him to ravage her, he'd flee the car and stammer an apology, maybe politely ask her where her boobs had gone. "Oh, sorry, that was mostly bra." He doesn't want to cheat on his wife. He wants girls to laugh at his jokes and to be in awe of his car. He wants to feel the way he did back when he was a cool dude in high school and not a 26-year-old slaving away in an office with a kid at home, watching his prime tick away one can of Red Bull at a time. It was all harmless. They arrived at the apartment the sex shop wore as a hat, and Amy saw David's car was gone. So he was still out working his missing girl case without her. She juggled her umbrella and headed around toward the side entrance, the pink Venus flytrap neon buzzing overhead. She passed the one-armed concrete snowman at the bottom of the stairs, headed up, shook off her umbrella, and pushed her way through the door to the apartment. She glimpsed the kitchenette and, just for a moment, thought she saw something strange. It was David, standing there with a mixing bowl in one hand and a whisk in the other, like he was in the middle of cooking something. And she wasn't even really sure she saw this. In that moment, he wasn't moving, like, at all. He was standing perfectly frozen, facing the window to Amy's left. He wasn't mixing, he wasn't blinking, he wasn't breathing. He was just standing for a solid 2 seconds. Then Amy came through the door, and all at once he popped into action, like a video that had been unpaused. "Weird. Were you transfixed by something outside?" David said. "What's that?" "You were staring out the window." "Was I? Just looking at the rain, I guess." "Did you solve the thing with the little girl?" "We did. She's back home safe and sound. Turned out there was nothing clown dick about it. It was just a local creep. We got the cops to track his phone and found his van. Whatever he was going to do, he never got a chance."
"Thanks to you."
"Thanks to us."
"Holy crap, David! You guys are heroes! This is amazing!"
Amy thought she heard something unusual, but couldn't put her finger on it. Then she suddenly realized it was what she wasn't hearing. She poked her head into the bathroom and confirmed it. No plink, plink, plink of the roof leak.
"Hey, they fixed the leak! This is the best day ever."
"Actually, I did. Got tired of waiting on the landlord. I went up and it was pretty easy to see.
There was just a gap in the flashing around an exhaust vent up there. All I had to do was squirt a bunch of silicone caulk in the crack. Took $5 and 15 minutes. Should have done it months ago.
Still, I'm impressed.
Didn't know you even knew how to do that sort of thing.
I didn't. I looked it up. It's not brain surgery. I'm making you waffles. You hungry?
She wasn't.